I pledge to serve the people of Wisconsin, the first district, honorably. And in order to serve the people in my district honorably, I have to serve them honestly. And for me to ask them to vote to re-elect me, knowing that I wasn't going to stay, is not being honest. So I simply cannot do that. So that's why I'm announcing this today. Again, I am proud of what this conference has achieved, and I believe its future is bright. The economy is strong. We've given Americans greater confidence in their lives. And I have every confidence that I'll be handing this gavel on to the next Republican Speaker of the House next year.
House Speaker Paul Ryan announcing this morning that he plans to leave Congress at the beginning of next year. Ryan's decision opens a leadership vacuum as Republicans head into what could be a difficult midterm election season. But that does not mean there aren't some already angling for Ryan's seat. One of them, California's Kevin McCarthy. The House Majority Leader reportedly has been mounting a behind-the-scenes campaign for the speakership, on the chance that Ryan would retire. Here to tell us about McCarthy's planned bid is Sarah Weier. She covers California's congressional delegation for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so you report that he's been quietly shoring up support behind the scenes for quite some time, thinking that Paul Ryan might retire. What does that look like?
Well, it's kind of one of those worst-kept secrets on Capitol Hill. He's wanted to be Speaker for a very long time, and he's a very prolific fundraiser. He's been crisscrossing the country raising money for fellow Republicans. That includes some of the more conservative members who blocked him from becoming Speaker back in 2015.
And why was he blocked back then?
Some of the conservatives didn't feel that he was conservative enough for them, or were not willing to bow to some of their demands, some of the demands that actually pushed John Boehner out of office. And he's been really working to develop those relationships and show that even if he's not himself a far-right conservative, he's willing to hear them and at least let their policies come to the floor.
So one of the people that he has been shoring up support with has been the president, Donald Trump. I mean, he is really cozy with the president. I think the president calls him my Kevin. And today, McCarthy tweeted, "There is more work to do this year, and we will do it together as a team." And he ended his tweet with hashtag MAGA, or Make America Great Again. So what's he doing there?
Well, he's been really working to cultivate that relationship. In the last year, there's a story the Washington Post had that he realized that the president only liked pink Starbursts, and so he had his staff go through a bag of Starbursts and pull out just the flavor the president liked and sent it to the president. It's those kind of little personal anecdotes and familiarities that really make McCarthy stand out as a politician. And he was actually tasked with sitting the president down and explaining to him why Republicans might struggle to retain the House in the midterms. And I think President Trump really respects him. He really likes him. Like you said, he refers to him as my Kevin. But at the same time, he really likes the other Republican who might be in the running, who has expressed interest, perhaps, Steve Scalise of Louisiana. Scalise has a lot of favor and respect on Capitol Hill, and you know, the president also really respects him as well.
Yeah, and he was shot at that baseball game, so he's now considered a hero in some ways.
Yeah.
But what would the president have to do with this? I mean, this vote for the next speaker takes place amongst House Republicans.
That's true, but the president is still the de facto leader of the party, and there are a lot of House members, even if they don't outwardly embrace the president, they take what he says very seriously. And I think they've seen what it's like when the president and the House and Senate leadership don't necessarily get along, and the idea of having someone that the president likes and gets along with might push McCarthy in their favor.
Okay, so it could be that he has no speakership to run for because the House could turn and become democratically controlled.
Yes, that's very true, and that's been kind of the speculation behind waiting to hold this vote until November. There's less interest in a minority leader fight than there is in a House Speaker's fight.
Right.
One interesting fact would be that if, regardless, if both of McCarthy and Pelosi hold their current leadership positions, and one becomes Speaker and the other is Minority Leader, it would be the first time in American history that they both have come from the same state.
Ah, interesting. Well, so what does this mean for California, that there is this battle for power at the highest levels and it's all coming from California?
Well, it definitely shows how influential the California delegation is and really how much power they have. I mean, even on the Republican side, where you only have 14 members of the 55 delegation being Republicans, that they are so high in House leadership and so many of them hold committee chairmanships, this fight's going to be very interesting to watch.
Right. Okay, so, but what does it mean now that Paul Ryan is, I guess, essentially a lame duck for the rest of the year? Does that mean that McCarthy does have more interim power?
It could. You know, I was just speaking with a California Republican, and he said that this kind of frees Paul Ryan up a little bit to address some of the issues that he might want to bring up to the House floor, but don't necessarily have the support of the president or have the support of some of the more conservative Republicans. So I know he was hoping that it means Paul Ryan will bring up perhaps immigration or some other big issues. From McCarthy's standpoint, he's going to have a lot of eyes on him for the next 7 months as people watch to see if he is prepared and ready to be Speaker. That was something that came up back in 2015 when he ran, was he had that kind of a gaffe on Fox News where he seemed to say that the Benghazi investigation the House was doing was to make Hillary Clinton look bad.
Hmm.
And he walked that back, but it kind of raised a couple of eyebrows of whether he was ready to be in that position. And so this is the second shot at a job that he's really wanted for a long time.
Sarah Weyer covers California's congressional delegation for the LA Times. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
All right, state politics now, and a new bill that would make some major changes to health care here in California. It would allow the state to set prices for things like doctor's appointments, surgery, hospital stays. Those prices would be determined by an independent commission, and they'd be based on Medicare rates. Democratic Assemblyman Ash Kalra from San Jose introduced the bill Monday at a press conference.
Reining in skyrocketing health care prices is the first step in any serious effort to deliver life-saving care to more Californians and relieve the pressure that soaring health care costs place on working families. That is why I am introducing AB 3087, the Health Care Price Relief Act, which will establish an independent health care cost, quality, and equity commission.
Well, consumer groups and labor unions like the bill. Hospitals, many doctors, and insurance companies do not. We're going to get some pro-con now with Dr. Theodore Mazur. He's an ear, nose, and throat specialist in San Diego and president of the California Medical Association. Welcome to the program, doctor.
Thank you.
Joining us also, Richard Scheffler. He's a professor of health economics at UC Berkeley. Hello there.
Hello.
So about 18% of GDP here in the United States goes to health care. That's double what other developed countries spend. And this is according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. In California, premiums keep jumping. They've jumped more than 240% in recent years for people who get their insurance through their employer. Richard, you have studied this. This is your area of expertise. Briefly, and I know it's very, very complicated, why is healthcare so expensive here?
We have an aging population, and they need more care. The big baby boomers are getting older. We have lots of new technology that can be useful in treating people. But in California also, we have a particular situation where the healthcare markets in California, the insurance markets and the hospital markets, are what we call very concentrated, where there are fewer and fewer insurance companies and fewer hospitals. And so there's less competition, which is usually the mechanism we use to drive down prices and improve quality in our healthcare system.
Dr. Theodore Mazur, let's bring you into this. And what do you say to those points? Do you agree with Professor Scheffler that these are the primary drivers of healthcare costs?
those are definitely primary drivers, as well as the constant American demand for the latest, greatest, best, whether you need it or not. And I find it very interesting that the professor is citing things like consolidation, which we at the Medical Association have always been concerned about, as justification to support this kind of a program, since the way we see this is by not controlling costs of rendering care, but simply by controlling payment in a marketplace that already shifts the cost of government-promised care under Medi-Cal to the private sector, you will drive smaller practices and that competition out of the marketplace and actually increase consolidation, which, as he has said, is known to increase the actual costs to the public and to purchases of health care.
But what about basic costs for services? I mean, it does cost more to get basic services here in the United States than elsewhere. And for example, I'll just cite an MRI scan in the United States costs, on average, about $1,100. And that compare that to $138 in Switzerland.
I want to be careful about talking price versus cost. We're talking about what insurance companies have negotiated. We're talking about billing, not payment. And that, again, is one of the issues here. Yes, American medicine is more expensive. There are lots of reasons for that. They vary from consumerism and demand, pharmacy costs, which is one of the main drivers of increased costs. Remember that physicians account for less than 10% of the costs of health care. And at this point, we've had no increases of any significance in either Medicare or Medi-Cal, which means that the private sector has had to consume the fact that this is the most expensive state in the nation to practice medicine. The actual cost of rendering care are highest in this state, with the lowest Medicaid reimbursement rate and not the very highest Medicare rates. Now, for a commission that refuses to even allow the expertise of physicians on that commission, and that's in the bill, to then say we're simply going to lower payment without dealing with the cost factors of rendering care, squeezes the market out and will result in probable closures not only of physician practices, but also of hospitals, the smaller hospitals already struggling under the current economic climate.
And Professor Scheffler, why not include physicians on this panel?
You can see the nurses, the doctors, the pharmacists, and all the different health professionals arguing their point of view, and they have, of course, a strong interest of their members. And so I think generally commissions try to have people who are not really tied to the economic outcome. I don't mean just this commission, but I mean almost any commission. Healthcare is expensive in the United States, no doubt. And the most important thing is it's getting more expensive. It's not the level, but the trend.
Do you think that setting prices for doctors and other services would go a significant way to reducing those costs?
I think it would, but I'm not sure that I'm in favor of doing that. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of prices in the healthcare system in California and Medicare and the commercials for drugs and the like. And what the commission suggests is that they want to tie things to the Medicare prices. Well, that works to some extent because Medicare does put out prices, but they set the prices in Washington.
The big problem of pegging rates to Medicare is that Medicare has not really kept up the pace of inflation. At least for physicians, we are way behind the inflation spiral to our own costs in the Medicare reimbursement rates. And we saw this for the last couple of decades, right, when we talked about the doc fix every year with the sustainable growth rate. We can't really look at Medicare as the model. And if a state commission is going to set budgetary caps and growth rates based upon the current economic fluctuations, that means if we have another recession, they're not going to allow for increases, even though the cost of rendering that care keeps on going up. We cannot have a master budget that doesn't recognize those services without doing exactly what 3087 is going to do. It's going to result in a non-elected bureaucratic commission without any expertise in medicine to set the rates and ration care by doing that, or force physicians and hospitals out of business, out of practice.
So as it is now for people who have private health insurance, the insurance companies set the rates, right, for many services. So,
well, no. The patient purchases a premium set by a health plan.
Right.
A doctor who chooses to contract with the health plan,
right,
gets an agreed contract rate, and there are many, many. This is part of the complications in dealing with healthcare finance. In San Diego, there are probably 100 or more different payment rates for the same contract. We'll take an example of Anthem. Every group has a different contract rate. You negotiate those, and at some point you say, no, I'm not going to accept that. And if a patient wants to see you who has that insurance, you should be able to negotiate a rate with the patient, as long as the patient is doing something on their own and it's not under duress of an emergency situation. So they can set rates in a negotiated contract. That's different from a bureaucracy from the state coming in and saying, all payers will only pay this certain amount. You know what that does? When they put that down at 100 or 110% of Medicare, it removes all of those contracts, and there is no place for physicians to go but leave the state.
I think the doctor made some really excellent points. I want to commend the people that put the bill together as starting this conversation between the two of us and other people. Healthcare costs are a problem. We need to talk about that, and we need to have a debate and transparency and data and get the ideas out there and make a sensible move forward. I would have a commission really talk about payment methods in general. You know, it's the beginning, Bill. It's a start. Having a conversation like this, I think, makes a great deal of sense.
All right. We'll leave it there at the beginning of a conversation. Richard Scheffler is a professor of health economics at UC Berkeley, and Dr. Theodore Mazur, physician based in San Diego and president of the California Medical Association. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, would you let a homeless person live in your backyard? We'll meet a woman who did as part of a solution to the homeless crisis. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. So we all know that homelessness is a big crisis here in Los Angeles. City and county officials have come up with a plan. Lots of homeowners have backyards, so why not get them to build tiny houses there and rent them to a homeless person? The county will give people a $75,000 loan to do that. And then after 10 years, the loan is forgiven and the homeowner has presumably upped the value of their property with that extra unit. Something similar has already happened in Seattle. It's a charity-based program, and it housed its first homeless person in someone's backyard in October. Kim Sherman is one of the owners of that backyard, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So you had this little house built in your backyard, and now it houses a formerly homeless man. How did you decide to do that?
You know, as soon as I heard about the program, I really wanted to be involved. That there's, like LA, we have a huge homelessness crisis here. And when I would walk to work in the morning, I would see, you know, as many as 100 homeless people in tents and just sleeping outside. And there'd be wheelchairs and sometimes a baby stroller parked outside the tents. And it's heartbreaking. And I wanted to do something, and this opportunity came up, and both my partner Dan and I just jumped on it immediately.
And what is the program exactly?
It's called the Block Project, and it's administered by a nonprofit in Seattle called Facing Homelessness. And they basically coordinate with social service agencies and city permitting officials and contractors to build a house in residential backyards. They find the residents, and they make sure they're connected with social services. They find the people who want to host and folks to volunteer to build the houses.
And then is this now part of your property?
It is. We don't own the house. We are leasing the land to the nonprofit.
Okay. So what is your, I mean, are you doing this purely out of altruistic purposes? Are you purely doing this because you want to help, or is there some kind of financial incentive for you as well?
There's no financial incentive. It seems like the right thing to do. And, money was sometimes the best things in life are the ones that don't include the exchange of money.
Hmm. Okay, so tell us about your tenant, the formerly homeless man.
His name is Robert, and he is just the sweetest man. He's going to be 76 this year. He'd been homeless for about a decade. He grew up in Canada and Idaho, and we just love having him as a neighbor. He's funny. He's got a lot of great stories. He's had a very different life from anything that Dan and I have experienced. So we feel really honored to know him.
Mm. And how did you find him, and how did you make the connection?
One of the social service agencies that the Block Project works with is called the Chief Seattle Club, and it is a day center for Native Americans in Seattle. And Facing Homelessness met with Chief Seattle Club and my partner Dan and I, and they asked us about our lifestyle and what was important to us and a neighbor, and you know, about our neighborhood and public transportation, and just, you know, figuring out all the details. And when we told them that we were pretty private people and introverts, and my partner Dan is a musician and I like to garden, they said, you need to meet Robert. He likes to garden. He's a quiet, independent man. He's just very, very sweet. We think you'll really like him.
Did you have any trepidation about this? I mean, a lot of homeless people have substance abuse issues or mental health problems. Were you frightened at all that it might not work out and it might be actually dangerous or uncomfortable?
We didn't have those sorts of trepidations. You know, as introverts, we're always worried things will be uncomfortable. But it hasn't been. Yeah, so I think that was really our only trepidation, like just sharing space with somebody and how that would work out and would we lose any privacy and that sort of thing. But I think because there was this matchmaking process, they were able to connect us with somebody who was just a really good fit for us.
Any pushback from your neighbors?
No, not at all. We went around and knocked on everybody's door. That's one of the conditions of participating in the Block Project, is that the entire block has to be on board with the project. So we went around and knocked on all the doors of our neighbors and left information for people who weren't home, and got responses ranging from no response to materials we left to enthusiastic response.
And any of your neighbors following suit, doing the same thing?
We've met some people through this who live in our neighborhood who are also interested in doing this. There's more than 100 homeowners who've signed up in Seattle to host a block house.
So obviously that's not going to solve the whole problem, but do you think that it would provide at least some kind of, I don't know, incentive for other people to be more charitable when considering housing the homeless, maybe in buildings in their neighborhood, not being so NIMBY-ish?
I hope so. I think that one of the things that's really different about Facing Homelessness is that their mission is really to build community as much as it is to house people. And one of the unique aspects of this program, and also what you're doing in LA, is that you're really integrating people into existing neighborhoods and support networks. So instead of having, you know, one low-income housing building where there's 100 people who have experienced homelessness and all the trauma that goes around, that comes along with that. You have people who are in a neighborhood that's maybe a little more stable with people who haven't gone through that trauma. So I'm hopeful that it will create housing, but it will also create a shift in how people who are housed see people who aren't.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for speaking with us today and telling us your story.
Thank you, Madeline. It's been a pleasure.
That's Kim Sherman. She and her partner are housing a formerly homeless man. His name is Robert Desjarlais in a new house in their backyard. Coming up, maybe you've heard of a guru named Osho from the celebrities who follow him or from the people who attend his spiritual retreats in India.
Especially on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, you'll see Osho quotes all the time on your feed.
Well, Osho's name used to be Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, and in the 1980s, he led thousands of his followers to build a utopia in the Oregon wilderness. That's all in the new documentary, Wild, Wild Country. We'll speak with the directors next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Netflix documentary Wild, Wild Country is one of those shows that's easy to obsess over. It follows a guy named Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, a fringe guru who began with a following in the small Indian city of Pune. Bhagwan wore long robes and talked about the power of meditation, but unlike more traditional gurus, he also loved money, sex, and cars. At the height of his popularity, he owned 93 Rolls Royces. In 1981, he made waves when he and his followers migrated to a tiny town in Oregon and started to build a new city called Rajneeshpuram. While the residents of the neighboring town were not too happy about that, panic spread about the so-called terrorist sex cult. And the story gets crazier from there. Think poison, voter fraud, sex parties, blah, blah, blah. Brothers Chapman and McLean Way directed Wild Wild Country, and they're in the studio now with me. Hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for having us.
Well, yeah, how did you come across this story? Because you guys are young. You don't really remember this.
Yeah.
It's happening in real time, right?
I mean, McLean and I were both born just right after this entire saga happened up in Oregon. And basically about 4 years ago, we were given access to over 300 hours of archive footage that documented this entire story and
movement. How did you get that
footage? We had worked with a film archivist up in Portland on our previous documentary that we did for Netflix. And so when he was asking us what we were doing next, we had a couple ideas, but nothing that we were too in love with.
And he kind of, this archivist said, hey, we have this collection of footage. It's 525 raw U-matic tapes, and it's on what he said was the most bizarre story that ever happened in the state of Oregon. And I was like, there's no way he has this right, because I just thought it would have been something I would have known about. But I did some kind of just quick Googling, and the story seemed to check out, and it seemed to almost be trapped within the state of Oregon. Because especially if you live through it in Oregon, you remember it. But then I talked to my parents, I talked to other people that were old enough to remember it. And if anything, they just kind of remembered the Rolls Royces.
Yeah.
So kind of started conceptualizing this as a six-part documentary series.
Okay, we're going to get to the poisoning and the busing and the homeless people.
Buckle up.
Yeah. But let's talk about first this idea of buying the 64,000 acre property,
right?
Why did they think that this was the place to have their headquarters?
Yeah. I mean, they had searched other areas in the United States. I think that, it was called the Big Muddy Ranch in Eastern Oregon, and it was the largest plot of land for sale in the Pacific Northwest. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons why they're really attracted to this land was that the closest town to it was 19 miles away. This kind of frontier post called Antelope.
Population?
40. So it was 40 residents. And I think they just felt like we're in the middle of nowhere. No one's going to care what we're doing out here. It's 64,000 acres. And they really saw it as their kind of holy land to which they were going to build their utopia.
Mm-hmm. I think even Bhagwan thought that, you know, India is a country that's had a lot of gurus, but how many gurus have come to America and really, quote unquote, transformed the consciousness of the planet? I mean, that was the ideals. That was their ambitions. I mean, their ambitions were sky high.
To transform the planet.
The consciousness of the planet.
Okay,
yeah.
So, and they were serious about that?
They were, yeah. I think that these are people who fundamentally believe that there's like a path that a human being can walk towards enlightenment. You know, in some sense, you're kind of expecting these followers to badmouth their experience, but they seem to really talk about this building Rajneeshpuram, this $125 million utopian society, as one of the most profound things that they've ever done in their entire life. And I think that for a lot of these followers, they thought that they would be living in Rajneeshpuram until the day that they died. So I think that their beliefs and commitment and devotion was sincere in what they thought that they were doing out there.
So they built all these living quarters. They built dams. They built farms.
They had a shopping mall.
They went
airport.
They were very productive.
Police department, fire department, hospital.
And they had their own bank.
They had their own banking
operation. How did they make all their money?
Yeah, there was a couple different ways. I think one of the first components was the guru Bhagwan was kind of the first guru to put his discourses on cassette tapes. And so he had this kind of worldwide shipping empire where people from the West, people in Berkeley, America, Europe, would buy these cassette tapes where they could listen to those discourses.
I'm not special in any sense. I'm not claiming that I am the son of God. I'm simply saying one thing, that I was asleep, now I am awake. You are asleep, and you can be awake also. I will go on trying to help people to be awake.
He also published over 300 books, so he was a very well-known author, and those who were part of the human potential movement in the New Age communities would buy his books. He was very popular. And then the third kind of component was a lot of wealthy followers would kind of donate their entire life savings to this movement.
Oh, I see. Okay. So there's a key right there.
Yeah.
What was it about him? Because you don't hear a lot from him. He didn't talk a lot. Why was he so charismatic to so many people?
Well, he had a PhD in philosophy. He actually started building this follower as this really intelligent, thought-provoking professor. And so basically he started doing like a tour, a lecture tour, where he'd go to universities in India and started building this following of highly intellectual Indians who felt, you know, disenfranchised with what was happening in their country, and were really looking to this intellectual quote-unquote guru to kind of show them the path towards enlightenment. Later that spread to Westerners, but he was a really revered thinker in India.
The East has remained lopsided because of the so-called spirituality. It has remained poor, unscientific, without any technology, and the West has chosen materialism. But man is very empty and meaningless without spirituality.
Let's talk about Sheila, because Sheila was the forward face of the organization. Right. So she was the Bhagwan's secretary, I guess.
Yeah, kind of, I mean,
right-hand woman.
CEO also.
Yeah, yeah, she basically ran the joint.
Exactly.
Right? And she was the one who talked with the townspeople and sort of tried to get what she and the group wanted.
Right.
And she's very charismatic. She's this young Indian woman who studied here in the United States.
I was not a meditator. I don't have interest in this. It's not my cup of tea. I like working. But it was not a conflict between me and Bhagwan. I knew his marketing ability. I knew how to create an organization, how to create capitalistic working community.
Sheila was smart, she was enjoyable, she was cunning. She had a feel for power.
She was very charming. She knew how to deal with people. She knew how to operate a new commune.
And yet, she's a complicated character.
Definitely.
She ended up fleeing the ranch, I guess, and
she did.
Fleeing the United States and ended up being prosecuted and spent some time
in
prison.
She was extradited back to the United States.
Federal prosecutors in this country have asked the West German government to extradite Ma Anand Sheila to the United States. Sheila, a former secretary of the Bhagwan Rajneesh, faces charges of fraud and attempted murder in Oregon.
So, first of all, why did she agree to talk with you?
Yeah, I think, you know, we were able to kind of get her on the phone a couple years ago. And initially, those first few minutes, she seemed kind of very reluctant about what we were doing and didn't have much interest in kind of revisiting this chapter of her life. But after kind of just talking to her about all the footage we'd found and kind of what we'd like to do with this story, it was clear that she felt like she's never really been given an opportunity to tell this story from her perception of the events. And so, you know, we told her, like, you know, we're not quote unquote journalists that are like, it's not an interrogation interview. Like, we're really here to have a conversation, a dialogue with you about your journey through this story. And I think that appealed to her.
I have been accused of laundry list of heinous crimes. Of course, all of them attempted. So the world has assassinated me and my character so often, I have nothing to lose.
So let's talk about the poisoning.
Yeah.
Because we have sort of talked a little bit about it. 700 plus people in the area fell ill from salmonella poisoning.
So the first part of the plan was to send Greyhound buses to all the major cities in America and bus in homeless people, which they did. They bused in about 5,000 homeless people. So suddenly you see the population of the ranch swell to about 7,500 people.
And then the whole purpose of that was so that they would vote.
Register
in the election.
As voters. Correct. This is all about the coming.
Oregon
upcoming
had
election.
Like the most liberal voter residency requirement laws at the time. So if you lived in Oregon for 21 days and you were over the age of 18, you could legally vote.
In northeastern Oregon, the followers of an Indian guru are now only a vote away from establishing and controlling Oregon's newest city.
And so this wasn't about helping out the homeless.
I mean, I think it was quid pro quo. I think in our experience, we interviewed a couple homeless people who didn't want to be on camera. And then we had hours of archival interviews with homeless people who participated in the ranch. And I think one of the more common things we heard from these interviews was that these are, the vast majority of them were Vietnam War veterans, and they felt like they were incredibly disillusioned with how America had treated them. And I think that they felt for the first time that the Rajneeshis were giving them a helping hand, and which meant free room, food, board. They could be a part of a community. And if they were asked to vote for the Rajneeshis, well, that was fine with them. They didn't mind doing that. So it's a little bit of a quid pro quo.
Yeah.
You can see why it would be manipulative and exploitative to begin with. I mean, I totally understand that. But the homeless was one prong to take over Wasco County. The other prong was to take salmonella culture and put it into 10 different salad bars at 10 different restaurants in the Dalles, Oregon. And so people would dine out, they'd eat at these salad bars, and over 751 people got sick with salmonella poisoning. No one died, but it was still...
The point was to get them sick enough to suppress the vote.
Exactly. So that they would be sick enough on an election day that they wouldn't be able to vote.
That's crazy.
Kind of sounds like Batman, the Joker.
Right? I mean, yeah. Was this all Sheila?
Sheila is interesting in the sense that she doesn't admit to everything, which I think does lend some issues to her credibility, but she will give justifications for why certain things had to happen on the ranch to protect her community. That was kind of as far as we were able to get with Sheila.
When you asked her, did you intentionally set out to poison the populace?
Yeah. Her response, which we put in the series, was that I've served my prison time. I've done my time. I'm no longer a criminal. In Switzerland, once someone serves their time, they're no longer a criminal. And so she said that was her response.
But she doesn't express remorse.
No, not really.
She doesn't. I think that she feels like this is a story of religious prejudice and persecution.
And she had to do whatever she had to do.
And that she was pushed to defend her community.
I think she felt like almost an attitude of like, all is fair in love and war, you know?
So when you started this whole thing, you got your 300 plus hours of tape. And did you think of the cult or the organization, whatever you want to call it, in one way? And then did you kind of shift your opinion?
I think like the first thing we Googled that came up was like a terrorist sex cult article that was written like on a 30-year anniversary, like 5 years ago. As soon as we started interviewing Sannyasins, both current followers and ex-followers, the first thing that really surprised us was really how intelligent these people are and were. You know, these were highly successful, career-driven people that had found that career success didn't give them the fulfillment that they thought it was and or that they thought it would, and, you know, set out on this kind of epic journey to create this community, to create their own happiness. And so when you start talking to them, you realize, like, is there anything more American than what they set out to do? You know, it's the American dream to build your own happiness in your own community. So definitely the more time you spend with them, you realize that you can't just put them in this like dismissive category of brainwashed cult followers. You know, these were all consenting adults that joined this movement. And so definitely an eye-opening experience.
Just like you can't really put these Antelopians in this like redneck bigot type of box, which is certainly what they were put into. And hopefully Wild Country is a series where, for better or worse, you're kind of forced to take sides at some point or feel empathy for someone at some point. And then you then question that like 10, 15 minutes later as you're hearing about a new perspective. And I think we were always interested in pushing an audience to critically think about these types of issues, regardless of what the conclusion was.
So I guess what's interesting is the whole thing is still carrying on to this day, right?
Yeah. So he changed his name from Bhagwan Rajneesh to Osho, which is, you know, when you travel around the world, Osho is a very well-known spiritual teacher. I think they have hundreds of book contracts with publishers all over the world. He's got his own section in Barnes & Noble.
And they're republished under kind of the new Osho brand name and things like that. Yeah, so the book sales are high, and it's a very profitable
business. And
there's
a lot of celebrities that, you know, claim to be Osho lovers and readers. And especially on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, you'll see Osho quotes all the time on your feed. There's an organization that runs the ashram, the commune out of India, which is kind of a worldwide destination center for those looking for spirituality retreats.
It's kind of a meditation spa resort that you book like 7 days, 2 weeks at, and you take all these kind of therapy classes, and very still much dedicated to Bhagwan's teachings, or Osho's teachings, which is interesting.
Well, thank you both so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking to us. We really appreciate it.
That's McLean and Chapman Way, the directors of Wild, Wild Country. It's on Netflix. Coming up, we'll remember a woman who gave a lot of big-name comedians their first break. Mitzi Shore, the owner of the Comedy Store, has died. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, a legend, and we use that word a lot in entertainment, but in this case, it is the perfect word. A legend of the comedy world has died. Mitzi Shore, owner of the Comedy Store, passed away. She was 87 years old. The Comedy Store on the Strip was a proving ground for a long list of big-time comics. Think Robin Williams, Richard Pryor, Gary Shandling, Billy Crystal, Jim Carrey, Chris Rock, etc., etc., etc. Also, Tom Dreesen. He's an actor and comedian and a consultant on the Showtime series I'm Dying Up Here, which is a fictionalized drama based on the 70s LA comedy scene and the Comedy stories central to it. And Tom Dreesen joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. It's a sad day. Mitzi was a comedy icon, no question about it.
Well, describe what it was like when she was running it.
You have to understand, to go back in time, in 1975, wherever you went in America, people say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. The next question out of their mouth was, oh, yeah, have you ever been on Johnny Carson? And if you hadn't been on Johnny Carson, in the eyes of America, you just weren't a comedian. And how do you get to Johnny Carson? You had to come to the West Coast, and the only game in town in those days, there was no improvisation here in those days, was the Comedy Store on Sunset Boulevard. And comedy became the rock and roll of the 70s.
Hmm.
You know, comics are being discovered every single night. All the talent coordinators, all the powerful people in our business, managers, agents, people who book these talk shows, all came to the Comedy Store to find the new comedy talent. And so to get on at the Comedy Store was far more pressure sometimes than doing your first Tonight Show. 5 minutes in front of Mitzi decided whether you went back to Harvey, Illinois, or Toledo, or New York.
And what was she looking for?
You know, she had her own idea of what worked in comedy and also what worked at her place. And by and large, in those days, it was clean comedy, clean, clever comedy, because she knew that also would get them on television. Certainly, you know, she ran a very successful. Nobody ever ran a comedy club that successful before Mitzi. And Mitzi, you know, the other places, it's like Bud Friedman started the first comedy club in New York, the improvisation. But in those days, they used singer, comic, singer, comic. Mitzi became the Henry Ford of comedy, where she put five comedians on an assembly line, five on the 8 o'clock show, five on the 10 o'clock show, five on the midnight show. Each did 20 minutes, 18 to 20 minutes, and got off. Boom, 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 you know.
Well, as portrayed in the show, the fictionalized version, I'm Dying Up Here, she was pretty formidable, and it seemed kind of scary to perform in front of her.
Well, you know, first of all, she was the power. She was a nice woman, a nice woman. She was strong and tough. She had been married to a comedian for years, so she knew the comedy life. But in those days, you couldn't work blue. There was no cable television in those days, so you couldn't work dirty. If you were going to work dirty, you couldn't get on to television. You know, today they have cable television. You can be as filthy a comedian as you want, and you'll probably get a sitcom the next day. In those days, that was impossible, and Mitzi knew that. And so she groomed those comedians to television. So when you performed in front of her, you know, it was a real test. You know, and you were nervous, and you were scared, and you wanted to win her over, you know. So she was a powerhouse.
How did she come into this? I mean, you say she married a comedian, but how did she know comedy?
Sammy Shore was her husband, and Sammy was in comedy and is still alive today. Sammy, she had traveled with him around the country. She knew all about comedians. He started the Comedy Store. She won it in a divorce, but then she revolutionized it. You know, she turned it into what it was, the moneymaker that it is even to this day, you know, because she was brilliant in that line. And she knew the psyche of comedians because she was married to one for years.
And this was largely a male world, the comedians, not a lot of women comics at that time. So it must have been, obviously rare and notable that here is a woman at the top of this.
Yeah, you know, she was like the mother to comedians. She, you know, they also, you know, she was a mother to the comedians. And being a mother, that meant she loved them, but she was also very strict with them. And she had certain rules that applied, and you applied by those rules or you didn't perform at the Comedy Store. But she encouraged women more than any other comedy club owner that I've ever known. She really brought women into the fold, and there are many women in comedy today because of Mitzi Shore.
Okay, so who owes their careers to her?
Oh, I mean, you know, Tom Dreesen. I that's where the Tonight Show saw me. That's where after my first appearance on the Tonight Show, I never stopped working. I ended up doing 61 appearances on the Tonight Show, and you'd break in your new material at the Comedy Store. But I mean, David Letterman. You know, you said it earlier. Gary Shandling, David Letterman, Robin Williams. You know, Michael Keaton used to work at the Comedy Store. There were so many people that owed their careers to her. However, that being said, would they have made it without her? Maybe, because they had extraordinary talent. But she was the perfect avenue to national television and to national recognition in her day. Success is an idea whose time has come. The Comedy Show was an idea whose time had come, and Mitzi was ahead of all that.
And she was also known for not paying her comedians.
Well, you know, and I was involved in that. The comedians went on strike in 1979 to get paid, you know, and it was just, you know, she had a view of the comedy club as it was like a college, and that's where they learned their craft. And of course, she charged at the door, and they made money. So the comics decided in 1979 that they wanted a part of that and a portion of that, you know. And that became an eight-week strike. Thus came the book I'm Dying Up Here by William Needleseeder, and thus came the series from that book.
Hmm. So did they win?
Yes. Well, the comics won after 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And Mitzi, you know, I sat down with Mitzi, and we negotiated a contract, and she decided to pay the comedians, and it was fair, and everybody made money after that. I mean, the comedians didn't make a ton of money, but they made enough money at least to eat after the show and put gas in their car and go out on audition.
So what was she like personally when she wasn't at the Comedy Store deciding whether or not you were going to get your 5 minutes?
She was a warm, personal woman who, you know, who just understood the psyche of a comedian, like I said earlier. So you could go to her for counsel or for financial help. You know, you could go to her for advice. You know, she was always open to that. She had some of her favorites, like most people do, you know, but those who knew her, and I had a personal relationship with her for years. We became on the outs because I led the comedians in the Comedy Store strike in 1979, and I sat and talked with her night after night. I talked to her on the phone and at her home, you know, about this, how much it pained me. I was making money working in Las Vegas, Atlantic City, all over the country, but I came back and stopped my career for 8 weeks to try to get the comedians paid. So our relationship became somewhat strained at times, but I always knew that you know, her heart was in the right place. You know.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for sharing your memories of Mitzi Shore with us today.
Well, may she rest in peace. She certainly revolutionized comedy the way it is today.
Tom Dreesen is an actor and a comedian. We've been remembering Mitzi Shore, the famed owner of the Comedy Store. She died at the age of 87. And he's back, the resident Norwegian, Christian Bordahl, back from a long extended vacation.
Yes,
but good to have you
back. Thank you. Well, earlier today, you talked to the Seattle homeowner who agreed to have a little house built in her backyard to house a homeless person. And LA is actually working on a similar program to pay homeowners to have little houses put in their backyard to house someone who's homeless.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked listeners if they would want to do that. 12% of them said, absolutely, sign me up. 49% said maybe, as long as I get input into who lives in the house. 39% said, I don't think so. So there's actually an interesting, lively conversation about this on our Facebook page and on KCLW's Facebook page that people could check in on.
All right, go check it out. Christian Bordahl, thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.